For our lesson this evening, I want to focus our thoughts for a few moments on the subject of heaven and our hope for heaven. Because one of the things that binds us together is that we have a common goal. And that is a goal to be not just together here for periods of time that we come together to worship in this life, but really to enjoy fellowship with one another in the presence of God and in the presence of Christ for all eternity. It is that common hope that so often binds people together and is such a key part of our relationship with one another as brothers and sisters in Christ. Yet when we say we want to talk about heaven and our hope of heaven, I think, to me at least, there are things about heaven that are really very difficult to comprehend, very difficult sometimes even to think about. And I believe that it is often a characteristic of us to, on the one hand, say, yes, we want to go to heaven, and yet not really to think that much about it or even to have difficulty in thinking about it. As a matter of fact, the American humorist Mark Twain, who sometimes had a fairly irreverent strain about him, once made the remark that he wasn't so sure he wanted to go to heaven. He said it sounded to him like all the really interesting people in life were going to be in hell. And there is an element of truth to that. The people that are chosen as subjects, for example, in literature and in the movies and TV are, well, the really interesting people, the ones that we get attracted to stories about are so often people whose lives are in opposition to the will of God, people that, according to the Bible, are not going to be present in heaven at all. Now, I think the counterpart to that is sometimes a lot of people have the sense, and I think this is probably what Mark Twain was suggesting, that all the people in heaven are going to be just really boring people, that heaven is going to be a place where not much happens, not much exciting happens, and who would really want to go there, and especially go there for all eternity? Well, I don't want to transgress propriety to try to claim more than we really do know about what heaven is going to be like. But this evening, I'd like to pose three questions and try to give biblical answers to each of those three questions about what heaven is going to be like that might help us to keep our hearts and our minds fixed on this goal. The first question we're going to talk about is, what will we be like when we get to heaven? Have you thought about that? You know, what am I actually going to be like? I suppose one of the questions that I, as a preacher, have been asked more frequently than almost any other question is, will we know each other when we get to heaven? And I think I know, the emotions that drive that question. I think there's very much a concern for, well, if we're going to know each other when we get to heaven, then we'll not only be able to recognize who is in heaven, but sooner or later we'll also recognize who's not going to be in heaven. And therefore the question arises, how can we be happy in heaven if people that we have known and loved on earth, we eventually discover that they are not there? And I understand that question, but I think it also is generated in part from saying, well, maybe we won't even be recognizable. Maybe we'll just be a kind of a ghost or something, and all ghosts look alike or something of that nature, so that we wouldn't even recognize or know who we are. Some people ask the question, would they know who they were? Would they even remember anything about their life on earth so as to have that type of self-identity? And so the question, what will we be like when we get to heaven? The second question, related to it in a sense, is, what will heaven be like? We know we have some descriptions of heaven. We'll talk briefly about those in a moment. But have you ever asked yourself that question as well? What will heaven itself be like? I know the Bible talks about street of gold, and did you ever ask yourself if that street had a curbstone? If it's got a curbstone, could I trip and stub my toe on that curb? We could make that sound real silly, but the question is, what is it that heaven is really going to be like? And then a third question, and though perhaps it's not asked quite as frequently, I think it does kind of lie down there in a disturbing way in many people, back of many people's minds, and that is, what will we be doing in heaven? And especially when you consider that whatever it is we will be doing it for all eternity. And there are lots of things here in this life that we found that we enjoy doing, but I'm not sure any of us have found something that we really think We would just enjoy doing that for all eternity. My wife might say something about chocolate in connection with that. I don't know. Some other women saying yes, too. But anyway, so question, what does the Bible teach us about what we're going to be doing in heaven? So these are the questions that I'd like for us to look at briefly this evening. What will we be like? What will heaven be like? And what will we be doing? To take the first of those questions, what will we be like in our own persons? I want to suggest that I think we probably have, a misconception. I find that I often still think in terms that I really believe are not quite according to what the Bible teaches. Let me give a little background before we look at some Bible passages. I think that our society has in many ways, not just that I think, most everybody that studies this type of thing would agree, that our society has been affected by a lot of different things. One of the things that has affected our society and our very way of thinking is the way the old Greeks thought, the Greeks that we meet in the Bible itself, in the New Testament period. And their idea was that everybody was composed of two parts, that he had a physical body and he had an immortal soul. You say, well, that sounds good. There are some passages in the Bible that indicate that. In fact, we'll look at those in a minute. But they not only thought in terms of man having a physical body and an immortal soul, but they also thought that the body was evil. They didn't have a Bible where they read Genesis chapter 1, where God created man and looked on what he had created and said it was good. They thought the Bible or the body was basically evil and that it was like a prison. And that what we ought to long for was for our soul to be able to escape from the prison of the body, and then the soul is the only thing that would endure forever. This idea is very much with us. In fact, you might be saying to yourself, well, yeah, that's kind of the way I think about it. In fact, it's even reflected to some degree in some of the songs that we sing. We have one, I don't recall us singing it here, at least not in a long time. When my body's lying in the cold, cold clay, I'll live on, for example. I would suggest that's probably the way I thought about it. But this whole idea that the body was basically evil, I think is an unbiblical teaching. It was also part of the teaching that led some in the first century to deny that Christ had come in the flesh. Since Christ was the pure Son of God, they just couldn't believe that he would inhabit an evil fleshly body. And so they denied that he had come in the flesh. And we read about that in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 3, 2 John, about false teachers who taught that Jesus had not come in the flesh. But as I say, I think that idea, though we understand that Jesus did come in the flesh, still, we tend to think, I think, a lot of times about heaven, at least I know I do, as a place that has nothing but immortal souls. Almost like it's just, thousands or maybe even millions of little ghosts floating around. And that's basically all it is. Now, what I'd like to suggest is I believe that the Bible does indeed teach that we have both a body and a soul, but it doesn't teach that our body is evil. And it doesn't teach that what eternity is going to be is just the getting rid of our body and then our soul living on forever and ever. What the Bible teaches over and over in the New Testament as the basis of our hope is not just the immortality of our soul, but the resurrection. And the funny thing is, that's what always got the disciples in trouble when they started preaching the resurrection. When Paul was preaching in Acts chapter 17, preaching famous Sermon on Mars Hill, there before the council of the city of Athens. We're told that he preached to them until it came down to the time that he mentioned the resurrection. And do you remember what their response was when he mentioned the coming resurrection? In Acts chapter 17, I'll turn and note the passage here. Says in verse 32, "Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer, but others said, 'We will hear you again concerning this.'" Some translations say some began to laugh, whether we understand laughing or sneering. Some thought this was a silly idea. And, of course, that was true. They all believed in the immortality of the soul. That was just standard fare. Any Greek believed you had an immortal soul. What they thought was ridiculous would be the idea that your body would be raised from the dead and reunited with your soul. They'd say, who would want that? Now, the point is that the Bible teaches us in many ways that it is exactly the resurrection that is our hope, not just the immortality of our soul. Notice, for example, in the Gospel of John, the 5th chapter. Before we turn there, I might just point to the example of Jesus himself. That Jesus, of course, is our example in his resurrection. And Jesus' resurrection and the eternal life that he gives, not based just on the fact that Jesus had a spirit or a soul that survived the death of his body on the cross. Well, if that was the case, it wouldn't have mattered whether his body stayed in the tomb or not. But the fact is, his body was raised from the dead and came out of the tomb, and the tomb was empty. And he appeared in his body to his disciples. And even in the Gospel of Luke, we read about him eating some fish with them and so on. Luke chapter 24 and verse 39, where they thought maybe he was just a ghost or just an apparition. And he said, no, give me some food. And he ate some food in their presence. But look especially, the passage mentioned just a second ago, the Gospel of John, the 5th chapter. In John chapter 5 and verses 28 and 29, Jesus says, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who were in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. He doesn't just talk about their immortal souls, but he talks about those who were in the tombs, those who have been buried, being called forth. He talks about the resurrection. For some, a resurrection to life, to eternal life. For others, a resurrection to judgment. And then to apply this actually both to those who were righteous and to those who were sinners, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 23. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 23, here the Apostle Paul is talking about our expectation and our awaiting the coming of Jesus, the second coming. And he says here in verse 23, now may the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely, and may your spirit and soul and body be preserved complete without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But then on the other hand, for those who are sinners, listen to the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, Matthew chapter 10 and verse 28, Jesus says here, do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul. And we might expect, now see, there's the distinction between soul and body. Yeah, there is very clearly the indication that we consist of both a body and a soul. But he doesn't go on and say, fear the one who is able to destroy the soul alone, but rather he says, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And that goes back to the fact that all, whether just or unjust, are going to be raised from the dead. And the picture that the Bible presents is not just an immortal soul, but a resurrection. At death, our soul is separated from our body. James chapter 2 and verse 26 talks about the fact that the body without the spirit is dead. But at the resurrection, the body is raised. And the body and the soul or the body and spirit are joined together once again. Now, I know that raised a lot of questions. It raised a lot of questions that I don't really profess to know the answer to. Somebody says, how can this happen? You know, a lot of people, when they die, nowadays a lot of people are cremated. That was true of a lot of people in ancient times too. A lot of people die, maybe not even intentionally being cremated, just the circumstances of the death lead to their body being scattered to the four winds, whether killed in battle or lost at sea or whatever. And so somebody says, you know, how can my body be raised from the dead when it may have just been scattered all over the dust of the earth? after I die. I would only say to that that we just need to remember that God made us from the dust of the ground to begin with, and if He could make us from the dust of the ground to begin with, He can do it again. But I would further draw our attention to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Because while the Bible teaches that our bodies will be raised, it doesn't teach that they'll just be just exactly the same as they are now. It teaches that they will be raised on the one hand, but it also teaches that our bodies will be transformed at that resurrection. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul addresses the very question about the nature of the body that somebody has when he is raised. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in verse 35, he says, "But someone will say, how are the dead raised? And with what kind of body do they come?" So we say, yeah, that's our question. What if we believe in the resurrection, not just the immortality of the soul, naturally we want to ask, what type of body will it be? And I think at this point, you know, a lot of us begin to speculate, you know, a transformed body. We could almost begin to joke about that. A lot of us say, I'd like a lot of transformation of my body when I get raised. Not real happy with all the features of it right now, you know, or something like that. But those are, of course, really worldly types of considerations, as real as they may be to us in this present life. He goes on to emphasize that it's like planting a seed. And when you plant a seed, there's something that grows up out of that. And the seed is a body, and it produces another body, a plant. And yet it's the same, but it's been transformed, changed from one thing into something, in that case, even much greater. And so he says in verse 36, he says, "You fool, that which you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And that which you sow, you do not sow the body which is to be, but a bare grain, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body just as He wished, to each of the seeds a body of its own." And then he talks about different types of flesh and different types of bodies and heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. In verse 40, he says, "There are also heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is one, the glory of the earthly is another." And he says it's the same way with the stars, for example. Verse 42, he says, "So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown a perishable body." That's the only kind of body that we really know. But somehow when it's raised, it's transformed. It is raised an imperishable body. "It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body." And I confess, I don't know exactly what a spiritual body is like. But I understand that he's telling me that I'm raised from the dead, and yet I'm transformed at the same time. And so, he goes on down to verse 50, he says, "Now I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable." This body, as I now know it, perishable flesh and blood, is going to be transformed. What will it look like? I don't know. Will I be able to pinch myself? I don't know. I wouldn't profess. I'm not sure the Bible really tries to answer those types of questions for us. But I think I learned something that's very, very important. And that is that when I get to heaven, when you get to heaven, we're not going to be just disembodied spirits with no identity, sort of just ghosts floating around. We're going to be real people. We're not just going to be real people. We're going to be, if anything, even more real, I think, than we are now. I believe perhaps in some ways that we might look back and think about what frail and weak creatures we are, how incomplete people we are now in comparison to what we'll be like when we have the imperishable body that bears the glory of heaven itself. But that's my point. It might seem like an awfully simple point, but I think as many times as people have indicated to me some sense that they just weren't even sure if they were going to know who they were, much less who anybody else was in heaven, suggests to me how easy it is for us to think that somehow we're going to lose our identity. We're not going to be real people. And yet the Bible teaches a resurrection, not just an immortal soul that somehow merges with all the other souls or something. That's what the Buddhists believe, you know, and the Hindus, that there's a soul that just eventually kind of merges back with all the other souls and loses its own identity. No, we're going to be very much real people, just as real as Adam and Eve were at the first creation, if not more so. Well, let me move on to the second question. Second question is, what will heaven itself be like? Once again, the Bible doesn't go into any great detail except in one place, and that's in the book of Revelation, chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21, we have a description of heaven. It's described, however, in a way that is hard for us to relate to sometimes. It is described as a city. You know, and we don't always think of a city as the most beautiful place in the world. Sometimes we think of a city as a place to get out of, not the place to get into. But it is described as a city of God, as a new Jerusalem that has come down out of heaven. Picking up in Revelation chapter 21 and say about verse 10, says, "He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper." And then he goes on to talk about the high wall and the 12 gates, and each of those gates is made of a single pearl. And it has in verse 14, "The wall had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb." The city is laid out a perfect square, 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles, or 12,000 furlongs, depending on which translation you're using, whether they've converted it to our measurements or not. Talks about the wall of jasper, and the city was of pure gold like clear glass. That's hard. You know, I don't think of pure gold as being like clear glass. But in all of these descriptions, we certainly can understand that heaven is designed to be the perfect place, the most beautiful and perfect thing that the mind of man could possibly imagine. And yet, I think we probably still have a pretty hard time relating to that. The street of gold is, fine, but how much more fun can you have on a street of gold than some other, depends on what you want to do. You might rather be on a field of grass, who knows, just from the way we think of it in our very limited human perspective. But also here in Revelation chapter 21, there's another way in which heaven is described, just very briefly. But in some ways, even though it's a very brief description, personally, it's easier for me to relate to. And that is in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 1, where he talks about not the new Jerusalem, but the new heaven and the new earth. Now, I know what the first heaven and the first earth are. That's the one we're still living in right now. It's been corrupted by sin, but it's the one that God created at the beginning, as we read about in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and where he placed the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve in that garden, and things have continued since. And that's the world that we live in. But he describes heaven there in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 1 as a new heavens and a new earth, a whole new creation. And I get the picture from that if we want to think of heaven, one Bible way to think about it is like starting all over again. Starting all over, but this time sin is not going to corrupt and destroy. And I would suggest that just as we will be real people in heaven, heaven itself is going to be a very real place. Now, if you ask me, is it going to have borders, and am I going to know when I've gotten to the end of heaven? And I don't know that kind of stuff. I think probably that's just beyond our understanding. I don't understand eternity and the things that relate to that. I believe what the Bible says, but I don't profess to be able to, fully comprehend all of that. But I can understand, I believe, that God is preparing a very real place for us. Let me suggest a couple of things. For one, it's interesting to me that for some reason, most people don't have a particularly difficult time. Most people who believe the Bible don't have a particularly difficult time thinking of hell as a real place. You know, we visualize those flames of fire and the worm that does, and that becomes very real. And we think of the pain as very real, too. But for some reason, people, I think, seem to have a hard time sometimes of thinking of heaven as very real. I would suggest, I think, in fact, what happens is we tend to think of this as the real world. And we say, heaven's kind of like it's almost like a realm of just shadows and spirits. It's almost like it's an unreal place. Now, maybe, as long as we're in this body, it's inevitable that we think that way. But I tell you, I honestly believe when we get to heaven, it'll be just exactly the other way around. Let me offer an analogy. Now, I've gotten interested in babies and their perspective, but I used this illustration before we ever had Kyle. And my illustration is this. We've, over the years, become acutely conscious of how much babies are sensitive to, even when they are in the womb. Kyle's birth mother, for example, told us what his favorite song was during the time, you know, that she was carrying him. And we now got a tape, and sure enough, he responded to that when we first started playing it like not any other. And we've become more aware, particularly as we've, you know, debated issues about abortion and so forth, how very much those little infants that are maturing in the mother's womb are already real people. Now think about this. Can you think, if you actually could talk, I mean, I know they can't talk our language at that point, but if you actually could communicate with a little infant in its mother's womb just a few days before it was to be born and try to explain to it that the real world is not the world in its mother's womb, the real world is the world outside. And the little baby, what do you mean? This is the real world. This is the only world I know. This is the real world. And he just couldn't imagine something that would be far greater and more real that would make him forget all about the world he had come from. And yet that's exactly, I think, what happens. We don't remember that world. We forget it, I suppose, very, very quickly. And yet there was a time when that seemed to us to be the most real place, the most that one could ever imagine. And then we are suddenly born into a world that reaches so far beyond that we can't even imagine. And I kind of think that may be what it might be like in heaven. That we'll look back and say, what babies we were. How little we understood of what the real blessings of God are. The real glory of God. And what things really could be in a world that was not corrupted and defiled by sin. So I want to say that I believe heaven will be just as real and just as perfectly suited to our immortal resurrected bodies as the Garden of Eden was suited to these flesh and blood bodies of Adam and Eve. But then the third question, what will we be doing? When we get to heaven, what will we be doing there? So I said, I think for many people this might be the most nagging of the questions. You know, there's one word that probably more commonly than any other we use to describe what we're going to be doing in heaven. That word is rest, and that's a good Bible word, too. As a matter of fact, that's a theme that's traced all throughout the Bible, leading eventually to heaven itself. We read about when God delivered the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, that they were headed to the promised land, which was to be their land of rest. And we think how many times that promised land, that land of Canaan, we sing about it as the rest land and use that as an image for heaven in our songs. And that's biblical because that's done in Psalm 95 and it's done in Hebrews chapter 4. And so the idea that heaven is our place of rest, you know, that's good Bible teaching. But what I think might not be such a good Bible teaching is maybe our idea of what rest is. We tend to think of rest almost exclusively in terms of, well, when you're real tired, you know, and you've been working real hard and you come plop down in a big easy chair, you know, and you just rest. And that is good feeling. And every one of us, whether it's a recliner chair or bed or what, you know, we've done that. We say that's good. And most of those of us who preached at some time or other have illustrated heaven that way. You know, that heaven is going to be like when you're through with the labors here in this life and we lay aside the labors and the toil and the sweat of this life. And we'll be able to sit down and rest. And up to that point, I think that's good, except that I don't think it goes far enough. I mean, I like to rest after I've worked real hard. I like to rest depending on what I'm doing. If it's the end of the day, I like to rest the whole night. If it's been working real hard all morning, I like a little afternoon nap or something like that. Yeah, I like that. But we're not talking about rest till you get your strength back. We're talking about for all eternity. You know, and the easy chair sounds good for the first hour or two of heaven, but you're going to be stuck there in the easy chair just doing nothing but resting for all eternity? And that I think we began, whether we put it in quite those words or not, we began to wonder, is this really what I want or not? But what I would suggest is this. If you go back and look in the Bible about rest and what rest really is, it's not sitting around doing nothing. God's never wanted lazy, do-nothing people who don't ever, who just sit around and do nothing. It'd be like, what did he create things for, just to do nothing? Let me offer a suggestion. Might give a little bit different perspective on this. In the Gospel of Luke, the 19th chapter, very familiar parable. Here in Luke, we know it as the parable of the pounds, although we're probably more familiar with the version in Matthew where it's the parable of the talents. But I want to look in Luke right here. Luke chapter 19, starting in verse 15. You know the general framework of the parable. A master called his slaves together as he was about to depart on a journey, and he had given each one of them, he had distributed 10 pounds among them, one to each of his 10 slaves. And when he returns, in verse 15, says, it came about that when he returned after receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves to whom he had given the money be called to him in order that he might know what business they had done. And the first appeared, saying, Master, your mina or pound has made 10 minas or pounds more. Now, let me pause right here. Think about the application I think we usually correctly make of this. We say this is what it's going to be like when we face God in judgment. He has entrusted things to us. We are stewards over things that really belong to Him. And we're going to have to give an account for what we have done with the things that God has entrusted us. Now, if that's correct, think about the implications of what happens here as we read on. When the first one reports and he says, Master, your mina or pound has made 10 minas more, he said to him in verse 17, Well done, good slave. Because you have been faithful in a very little thing, be in authority over 10 cities. Now think about that. You know, the way I think a lot of times we find ourselves thinking of heaven, we would have expected he would say, because you've been faithful, you don't have to do anything for all eternity. You know, you're off for good. You know, nothing but paid holiday from here on out. But he doesn't say that. He says, because you've been faithful in a little, he says, I got something a lot bigger for you. He says, because you have proved yourself here. He says, I've got 10 cities I want you to manage. Now, I wouldn't by any means, this is a parable, I wouldn't by any means try to say what this is teaching is that there are a lot of cities out there that the Lord's going to want us to run in a very literal sense in heaven. But it does suggest to me that if that's really the application, that our life here is not a life of trying to work real hard so we can get off and not have to do any more work for all the rest of eternity. We're actually being prepared for even greater things that God has for us in heaven itself. What they are, I wouldn't profess to know in all respects. I think a central thing is certainly going to be praising God, because that's the main thing we see people doing in heaven. But what all that may involve and what all God may have be preparing for us in that new heavens and new earth, I don't know. But I don't believe God's planning on us just sitting around doing nothing. You look in the Bible at the places that are the times of periods that are called periods of rest. You know, when the children of Israel arrived at the promised land, that promised land was their rest land. But that didn't mean it was a land where they sat down and did nothing. It meant it was a land where they could plant crops and expect them to grow, which they couldn't do out at the desert. It was a land where they could settle down and live in peace and prosperity. It was a land where they could be very busy doing what was rich and rewarding. And, you know, when you think about it, what really gives you rest? Yeah, I know if we've worked real hard physically or even mentally, that we can be tired and we need some time to rejuvenate. But what really gives us rest, for the most part, is not to do nothing. What really gives us rest, peace, contentment, is to do something that we're really suited to. Do something that we really enjoy. That's when we really feel at peace. That's when we really feel, I think, rest and relaxation. I think Adam and Eve were at rest in the Garden of Eden. And yet, they were responsible for it, to tend it and care for it. And I think it was just the perfect thing for them. I think we'll be doing real work, not toilsome work by the sweat of our brow that's a result of sin, but work that's just as perfectly suited to our eternal happiness as the work God gave Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden was to the way He created them and this world at the very beginning. Only maybe better, far more than we can realize. What's my point, really, in all of this? I think I could summarize it just with a simple little diagram. I summarize it by saying that in the Bible, we're told really about two creations. There is a first creation that we read about at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And in that first creation, it's known as paradise. And in that paradise, there is the tree of the garden. Draw a good tree, but that'll do. There's the tree there in the garden of paradise. And what do we have in that first creation? We have real people. And they were in a very real place, not an imaginary place, but a very real place. Granted, they were people that, because of sin, quickly became mortal. But still, they were real people in a real place, and they were doing real work. And yet, it was not the same as the work by the sweat of the brow that came as a result of sin. It was that which was, I think, fulfilling and rewarding and made their lives rich and happy. Well, what comes along? Sin comes along, and as a result of sin, all of this first creation is corrupted. It's corrupted. It's destined for destruction. It's the world that we live in right now. We live in a world that is destined to be destroyed. Sometimes that might be important for us to keep in mind. I mean, as much as I think it's important for us, you know, to, for example, conserve things and not destroy the world that God has given to us, we still have to realize that ultimately it is destined for destruction by God's own hands. And if we think of it as spaceship Earth, it's a spaceship that the Lord has declared He's going to destroy. But at the same time, He has also promised that there will be a new creation. A new creation, a new world in righteousness. It's going to be the new heavens and the new earth. And once again, if you look at Revelation chapter 2 and verse 7, this new heavens and the new earth is also called paradise, like the first creation. And if you look at Revelation chapter 22 and verse 2, you'll find that it too is going to have the tree of life that is there in the midst of it. What I'm suggesting is that though it's going to be different in ways that I think we really can't imagine or comprehend, that still that new creation that we call heaven is going to be a place where we're going to be real people in a real place and doing real work, but again, not burdensome work, but that which we've really been created for all along. And that's really the thrust of the lesson. I guess in some ways it doesn't answer the type of question somebody says, but I still want to know if I'm going to be able to pinch myself or if I'm going to recognize everybody and so on. And I think there are a lot of things about heaven we're just going to have to wait till we get there. We're going to be like that baby in the womb. We are right now like that baby in the womb. We're going to have to wait till we get there. That there's just no way for it to all be explained to us right now. But what I want to suggest is that this is not the real world, and that's the world of shadows. It's really the other way around. This is the world of shadows, where things disappear and are destroyed. That's the world of eternity and perfection and beauty and glory, when we can be everything that God made us to be, because we'll be delivered from our sin. Well, in just a second, we're going to stand and sing the song of invitation. A song that has been selected is number 640. It may be that there's someone here this evening who needs to respond to the invitation to confess Jesus, repent of their sins, and be forgiven by being baptized for the remission of their sins. If there's any one subject, we invite you to come while we stand and sing this song that's been selected.